Tuesday night edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast. Interesting show coming up today. I had a special guest, Corey Maggette, former Clipper and Warrior, Duke star as well. Also someone I actually went to high school in the same town with and graduated the same year. So he's someone whose career I'd followed for a long time. Had a great conversation with him, especially the second half of it is really awesome. We got into a lot of stuff about his playing career and the coaches he played for and how guys can handle roles off the bench. So stay tuned for that. But first, I wanted to have Danny on. We had to talk about the Celtics regular season funeral and also some of the news items like LeBron making these profanity-filled comments about the team's death last night, a few other news items as well. Our sponsor today, Blue Apron. You can get your first three meals free by going to blueapron.com/capspace, a fantastic food delivery service to cook meals at home. And let's get rolling, Danny. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Not bad. Enjoyed a good night of basketball. Sadly, yeah. However, we will not have time to discuss Andrew Wiggins' awesome game winner in Phoenix, nor shall we have time to discuss Dwayne Casey going for a quick two with 9 seconds left and no timeouts remaining. But we will get a chance to talk about this Wizards and Boston game. But first, let's talk about LeBron. Basically, lots of swear words saying essentially they don't have depth. They're top heavy as fuck, I think basically is how he put it. Lots of other F-bombs in this statement to a number of Cleveland beat reporters after they got worked by the Pelicans, which we talked about a little bit yesterday. What do you think of his complaints, Danny?
Maybe, just maybe, they'd be a little bit better if they didn't throw roster spots at guys that he used to play with that aren't good anymore.
Yeah, and I was actually on the radio in Cleveland today, and I made that same point when they asked me about it, that look, and LeBron was saying, hey, you know, there are guys who could have helped us, Raymond Felton, one who signed for the minimum as an example. And look, all those guys don't work out. You know, it's not, even Zaza Pachulia and David West have had their lumps, and those are guys who were signing for the minimum and were really undervalued at that price. Some of these other guys that LeBron was talking about or that might have been available for the minimum, the reason that they're available for the minimum is because they're a flyer. And so you really need to sign like three or four of those guys to hope that you're going to get, like, if you can get one guy who can play for you in the playoffs out of that, then you're in pretty decent shape. But Chris Anderson, they use a roster spot on him. Mo Williams, they kept him around just basically for savings so they could offload him. Anderson, they still have not released for that same reason. They're going to probably try and trade him away and pay someone to take him at the trade deadline. So you basically have had, you know, those two roster spots dead for most of the year. And then you have Chris Anderson, who couldn't play anyway, and then tore his ACL and now literally can't play.
What? And so I would add in James Jones too.
Like, yeah, I thought I mentioned him. If I didn't.
So that's a fifth of your roster just with those three guys. And they're not the only team that's wasting roster spots on guys, considering the Warriors have at least Anderson, Varejao, but probably Varejao and McAdoo. But Cleveland needs that depth more because they haven't been able to fill it out. And while I understand the rationale behind it, losing Matthew Dellavedova hurt them. It's a reasonable contract, but yeah, it was very expensive for Dan Gilbert. They absolutely could have kept him, though the downside of that, and theoretically it was a false choice between him and Mike Dunleavy, because all that was also Dan Gilbert money, because they could have just used part of the Anderson Varejao trade exception to bring in Dunleavy. They did it the way they did so that they wouldn't have to, but it
looks
like...
Well, keep in mind the timing though, because Dunleavy only became available when Wade signed in Chicago. They had already agreed to let Delly go at that point, so they didn't even know that they were going to be able to get Dunleavy at that point. Like, it wasn't...
It was a nice machination by David Griffin to make that happen with the pieces that had already been laid.
Yeah, so they basically, it wasn't like, oh, hey, we're choosing Dunleavy over Delly.
Oh,
it
hell
was,
no.
We're just going to let Delly go. And yeah, you know what? Like, he was probably a little overpaid. It would have cost them a lot of money. They probably would have had to give up assets to get off of some of the other money that they had. They wanted to re-sign Richard Jefferson for $2.5 million. It definitely would have cost money. And perhaps that's some of LeBron's frustration. They could have kept Delly if they had wanted to on that basically 4-year, $38 million deal that he signed in Milwaukee. And I think that wouldn't have been totally unfair contract for him, although again redundant for a guy who didn't play in the playoffs. And maybe they are thinking that Mo Williams would still be around. But my other concern here with LeBron is, yeah, you know, he's had to play a ton of minutes lately. He's had to play 44 minutes. Kyrie's playing 40. You know, he played I think 46 in that overtime loss to the Spurs the previous game. But it's not another effing playmaker that's causing you to give up 70 points in the first half to the Pelicans without Anthony Davis.
They also don't have many pieces in place in terms of their playoff rotation that can help their defense. They can get better internally. LeBron is actually a big part of that. He's a tone setter, and there have been a lot of games this year where he's taken it off defensively, and there's no problem with that because they don't need him to be that every single game, but it is a bigger issue, and it is one that's harder to improve.
Here's the other thing too. They need to get better this year, and I've made this point before, but I'll reiterate it, that yeah, they kind of had a crappy regular season last year and then turned it on in the playoffs, and they ended up beating the Warriors, but they really had to get very lucky to beat that Warriors team. The Steph injury, the Draymond injury, Bogut, Andre Iguodala's back locking up, all that stuff. The fact that game five was in Oracle instead of at home for them too, like that was another one. So having to win two straight on the road in Oracle with Draymond Green, that would have been really difficult. So all those aspects, really, now this Warriors seems to be even better than last year, most likely in the playoffs. And for them, they're going to have to get better than this. And so whether it's defensively, I mean, I do think they need some more bodies for right now. They also don't have J.R. Smith. They'd be feeling a lot better if they had him. With all that, I mean, I think the problem is just that they have to defend better. This depth thing is a problem, but maybe the Tyronn Lue needs to just play LeBron 33 minutes a game, 32 minutes a game, and let LeBron hopefully be able to play better defense because he's playing less minutes. And you can improve that way. And just, you know, if you get killed when LeBron's off the floor, so be it. I mean, you're still going to make the playoffs and be fine. You're at least going to build good habits that way.
It also illustrates the issue with using, I understand why they because the Hawks were willing to take on extra salary, so giving up the first is different than it would have been just trading a first for Kyle Korver. But Korver doesn't solve their problems, and it was one of the few pieces they had to get better. And it's unlikely that a player like Korver would be available on the buyout market, but it's also unlikely that he's going to be a huge factor in the series that matter the most for the Cavs.
Yeah, and I don't really see them being able to do any better until it gets to be buyout season, frankly, unless they're going to now trade their 2021 pick as well, you know, which is actually, if it weren't that lightly protected, I might be kind of interested in that pick if I were someone. But in any event, let's move on here. The Nuggets have waived Mo Williams.
Come on, somebody, anybody, let's keep this train going.
Stein reported that the Sixers are not going to reclaim him because they instead wanted to bring back Chess and Randall, and there are still some teams under the salary floor that could really use that savings. I'm rooting for it for sure. We got about 48 hours to see now. And then the Nuggets will sign Johnny O'Brien, former Bucks power forward who has been playing well for the Suns D-League affiliate Northern Arizona. I saw him at the D-League showcase in Toronto. I don't really know what good he's going to do the Nuggets because he is kind of like a scorer. He's just been posting up, not really like a ton of intelligence to play as a role guy. Doesn't really shoot threes, so I don't really get what the point of him is for the Nuggets. And they also have just a ton of talent and depth already, but hey, you know, might as well sign the guy and see. Maybe it's even just like a favor to get him some minutes for an agent, who knows, but I wouldn't expect him to make an impact there. What else we got here?
In an interesting move that I don't know all of the details on because not all of it has been released, the Utah system, like the team and the arena, which is really interesting, have been put into a trust, and the Miller family did this after, well, Larry passed a little while ago, but it's the billing of it by the team, and the NBA is apparently okay with it, is that they will basically be Utah's team moving forward without knowing all the specifics in terms of who has control and how they could theoretically like move or stewardship. It's not definite, but hey, anything that moves the team in that direction that keeps them more stable, I'm on board.
I love the Utah market. I love how they support their team. I've always had a great time when I've been there for Utah Summer League or for games. So I'm happy that it looks like they'll be staying here for the foreseeable future. And yeah, we don't know exactly what that document says, but it's being billed as essentially this is a trust. The Miller family will now not get any further profits from the team. And it seems like they're almost trying to go in the direction of like a Green Bay Packers type of like public trust type of thing. It's not going to be publicly owned with like fake stock the way the Packers have. But so that's a good thing for Utah. And kudos to Gail and Greg Miller for getting that done. In business news, the Celtics are announcing tomorrow a deal with GE that's going to include putting its logos on the jerseys starting next season. We'd gotten news a few months ago that the Sixers, who might actually be able to command a little bit more with the way their season is going if they haven't already reached this deal, were going to get $5 million a year for that, and that teams, big teams like the Warriors, could get like 20 for the ads in the jerseys. And, you know, all of this is just more BRI, more money for the players, more money for the owners, that everyone is happy. And I don't really have a problem with like a small logo on the jerseys. I do think it's interesting though that they are going to sell jerseys without the logo. Like, it's not going to be like the European jerseys where they sell it with like the advertising on it, which
is interesting.
For one, that seems to make the sponsorship less valuable, but I also like it because now there isn't this like planned obsolescence for jerseys where if they get a new sponsor, it's like your jersey is no good anymore. So I kind of like that aspect of it still. So I think I like that a little bit better. Couple more things here. What else we got?
Ben Simmons had a scan on his foot, which was scheduled, and it looked like everything was good. We still don't have a timeline yet, but anything vaguely positive I'm taking is good news.
Yeah, the fact that he hasn't had a setback, you know, still talk from Chris Haynes that it could be around the All-Star break, after the All-Star break when he returns, but he has reportedly been ramping up his workouts a little bit, and the fact that there wasn't any additional damage after doing that sounds good. And then the last thing we have here before we get to Washington and Boston, Memphis and Minnesota. Memphis currently is affiliated with the Iowa Energy. They are now going to sell that D-League team to Minnesota, which is close to Iowa, and then Memphis will be creating their own D-League team in northern Mississippi, just about 20 minutes south of Memphis. So we're getting closer and closer to the one-to-one affiliate team ratio, and good for Minnesota to get a D-League team. That's something that I think Tom Thibodeau probably has championed there, and good for them. That's all I got on that one, really.
Don't bury Tyus Jones there. Please. Please don't.
Hey, Tyus doing well in the D-League last year was sort of a big moment for him. He averaged like 25 a game over like six games.
That's true.
But yeah, he's a good NBA player now, or at least a decent one. What'd you have for Blue Apron this week?
It's actually sitting in my fridge because my delivery came today. I have a spiced salmon that I'm probably going to have. Well, it's not going to be tomorrow because we're doing the Twitter NBA show, but probably Thursday, which I'm really looking forward to.
Spiced salmon. Yeah, that actually does sound really good. Why is
their seafood is amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It's pretty good quality. Like I said, I think it's better, or at least as good as what you're going to get at a high-end grocery store, and probably, you know, when you're looking at less than $10 a person per meal with all the ingredients that you get. I mean, if you think about it, if you're just getting a fish fillet, you're probably almost at like $10 by that point. So Blue Apron is a great way to make food at home. Even if you're not that experienced of a cook, the directions are really easy to follow. My girlfriend and I make Blue Apron twice a week. We really enjoy doing it. Even when my freebie from them ran out, I still actually was paying for it because I just really enjoy their service. The quality is great. No food waste because they give you the exact amount of each ingredient that you need. And you can now get three meals free, your first three meals free, via the blueapron.com/capspace URL that also lets them know, of course, that you came from us. Support the show, blueapron.com/capspace. We talk about capspace all the time in the program. That's how you can remember that code, or in this case, that URL. blueapron.com/capspace gets you your first three meals free with them. All right, it was a rather funereal atmosphere in Washington, as I think if I had to guess just from the reporting, it was probably John Wall and Brad Beal who decided that everyone was going to wear black, like it was going to be the Celtics funeral in a regular season game. A little over the top, but given all of the bad blood between these teams, I actually like kind of enjoyed the whole stunt, even if guys like Jason Smith and Marcin Gortat are like these veterans who, you know, like weren't going to be doing this. Like Gortat even said, hey, you know, I'm wearing black, but you know, don't blame me for this one, as he walked into the locker room. But I mean, it was a good, I thought it was just a cool stunt to just ramp up the anticipation. I mean, are we doing this game if they hadn't done that? Probably not. And a way to get some attention on this Wizards team that doesn't get that much of it.
I think the place to start with this game is just a basic question to you, which is how much of what happened in this game was Washington being unsustainably good on offense, and how much of it was Boston just being bad at defense?
Part of it was the Wizards hitting tough shots, for sure. Although they ended up only going 9 out of 20 on threes, they were ridiculous in the first quarter. They had an 83% effective field goal percentage, and the only reason the carnage wasn't worse than the 33 points on 25 possessions was that they turned it over quite a bit. And they continued to play really well, had a 66-59 halftime lead in what was not an incredibly fast-paced game. So over a 130 offensive rating for the Wizards in the first half against what used to be a good Celtics defense. And, you know, it's kind of not anymore, as you alluded to. I've had a few conversations lately about why it is that the Celtics defense hasn't been as good this year. And there are three or four things that come to mind. One that we've hit on before is they're not forcing turnovers the way they did. They've been, these last 2 years, a really high turnover team. Another one is just that their center play on defense has kind of been inadequate. Amir Johnson is not really a starting caliber of player anymore. Their defensive rebounding has gotten from bad to atrocious. And then I also think they're not quite getting the same effort out of Avery Bradley and Jay Crowder. In part, it's always kind of weird how this works, that like when guys start playing better offensively, they don't play as well defensively. And I think just your identity kind of changes a little bit once you start hitting more shots. It's a rare player who can maintain that level of defensive fire once they kind of start thinking about themselves as more of an offensive player. And both those guys have been great offensively this year. And obviously Bradley didn't play in this one either, and Bradley Beal was able to torch Marcus Smart, much to Smart's chagrin.
Yeah, he ended up apologizing after the game because he had a tiff with the coaching staff, which was not something you see every day on the court, like in that sort of circumstance. Sometimes behind closed doors that can happen, but not like that.
It wasn't clear exactly what happened, right? But it seemed like he like made some attempt to like check back into the game once it was already over. I mean, the Wizards were up comfortably by 10 points basically throughout the fourth quarter, and Smart, I think what really set him aboil was Brad Beal coming down on the fast break and getting an and one and basically going about as far as you can to taunt someone without getting a technical. And you remember Beal and Smart have got into it before. Smart looked like he was going to give Beal another miserable day, like he had a couple of times where he ripped him early in the game, but Beal ultimately ended up going off for 31 points on 12 of 18 from the field, just a remarkable, and five assists too, remarkable performance by him. And I think, you know, part of that too is when Smart was out of the game, maybe that's part of what he was upset by. But yeah, he wrote a very nice apology to it, although he then just like screenshotted the notes from his phone and posted it on Twitter. But nonetheless, it was a very frustrating loss for Boston, given how much the Wizards had postured.
The Wizards have not lost a game at home since December 6th against the Magic, when Elfrid Payton actually went off.
14 in a row. 14 yeah, in a row now.
They've been great. It has fueled a lot of their success. They've been good on the road too, but they've been remarkable at home. And the only other game they lost since Thanksgiving at home was to the Spurs. So not a bad run for them at all. And in this game, they were 57.8% from the field, 45% from three, 85% from the line. Any team would be thrilled for that against any opponent.
Yeah, putting up a .123 was pretty good. 123-108 was the final score. And this wasn't a case where Boston got killed on the offensive glass. Only 7 offensive rebounds, although some of them were some key tip-ins by Markieff Morris and Martin Gortat. Isaiah Thomas was really good in the first half of this game. I think he had 18, but then fell off in the second half, finished with 25 points on 7 out of 19 from the field, although he did have 13 assists. 8 of those came in the first half, and he was outplayed by John Wall. Wall had 27 points, 7 assists. There was a great dynamic, though, with Wall guarding Thomas, where Thomas was able to get past him in the pick and roll. You know, there's a screen there, obviously, and then Thomas would try to go in for the layup, and Wall, who we've christened the best shot blocking point guard of all time, would try to come in from behind and block him. One time Isaiah pump fake and got a foul. Another time Wall got a spectacular block, but Wall trying to catch up with him on the pick and roll was very interesting. And I thought Wall played better defensively in this game than he has in a while, showed more defensive effort, showed that he, you know, can still be a really good defensive point guard, you know, when the mood strikes him.
I was also intrigued to see Jaylen Brown's role change between the halves, because he started out the second half and I thought he looked fine out there. Not great, but good enough.
Amir Johnson only played 4 minutes. He started at center, was -5 in those 4 minutes. And
that's not even Brown a Bogans.
Yeah, that's right, because he didn't even come back again for the second half. And Bogans would at least play like most of the first quarter when he was in. But yeah, Brown started the second half with Avery Bradley out and Gerald Green also ill. That was part of the issue. Stevens didn't really have anywhere else to turn. And Brown, 8 points, 3 of 6 from the field, did get on the defensive glass in this game, which is something he needs to do more of if he's going to play at the four, had 5 defensive rebounds in his 24 minutes. But he's in such a different situation from most of these rookies, because he's just not in a situation where he can be aggressive with the ball in his hands. Even someone like Jamal Murray, while he's coming off the bench, his role, at least when he gets out there, is to score, while Brown is pretty much never asked to create the play unless he's in transition. So, you know, he has some flashes. I think the form on his jump shot looks pretty good, but it's really, I think I'll be more interested to see what he does in summer league almost than like the rest of the season, because he's just, and I also worry a little bit about him defensively. Like I've never actually, surprisingly, though I liked him, I was always been higher on his offense and his ability to attack off the dribble and lower on his defense, I think, than a lot of people, because he's got just a tendency to get out of his stance and get blown by, make some dumb rookie mistakes, that kind of stuff. Anything else you had on this game? I guess we should talk about Gortat, how good he was in this game too.
Gortat was great, very efficient from the field, knows how to get his space, how to get a shot, set some good screens. I love his fit with this team and the chemistry that you can only get by time and experience, with particularly with John Wall, but more with Bradley Beal too. He's doing a better job there as well.
Yeah, Gortat's still an excellent pick and roll center, both with the screens that he sets and then also his ability to catch and finish in the lane. He's great at finding little angles, reaching back for the pass. You'll never see him just like bobble a pass out of bounds the way a lot of centers do. Another guy who played really well, 30 minutes for Kelly Oubre, plus 10. The fact that they've been able to get minutes out of him, I mean, remember they signed Andrew Nicholson to a $6 million a year contract over 4 years to be their backup four. Nicholson hasn't been in the rotation since like the first month of the season, and now Oubre basically is their backup four, and he's been successful in that role. He also was pretty good defending Isaiah Thomas. He has that 7'2 wingspan. He's getting better. And most importantly, he's hitting his shots too from 3-point range of late. He was 3 out of 6 on threes and plus 10, which was excellent. And the Wizards bench also gave them something, at least didn't get killed. Trey Burke had another decent game with 6 points in 10 minutes. That's really all they need out of him.
Woo-woo.
Yeah. No, I mean, like that level of playmaking, if he could just like keep the house from burning down when he's in there, like that's all they really need from him. And Jason Smith was totally okay too, again, defensively, like didn't get killed. And that's all they need from those guys. So this Wizards team, Otto Porter, 2 of 2 on threes. He is now leading the NBA in 3-point percentage. That's another kind of ridiculous stat, although he doesn't have a ton of volume. This Wizards team is good. We said it last night when we talked about them with Charlotte. I mean, they're really playing better right now than anybody in the East, frankly, because the entire conference is taking this huge dump since January. They and the Sixers are like the only two good teams in the East since the turn of the year. But I mean, this Wizards team is dangerous right now, especially with Toronto and Boston to a lesser extent in free fall. You have to say they and the Hawks are kind of playing the best. I guess the Hawks are the other team that's been playing pretty well right now.
Another point I wanted to make with Washington is that while we're far, far away from the playoffs and injuries can happen, their starting five plus Oubre can get the lion's share of their minutes as long as Scottie Brooks is willing to run the kind of rotation necessary to run, basically have a 7 or 8 man rotation, but really 6.5 to 7 to have use. Basically, you want those guys, a backup center, and then ideally a one to fill some of those minutes. If you run that right, that's really all you need.
Yeah, I will say that Jason Smith, he playing him at center does help. Just, I mean, even though he's spacing out for long twos, that does help some of these more limited guys like Burke and Satoransky and Oubre, or even someone like Markieff Morris, who they'll go to for offense on the second unit sometime. His spacing, it does help them. For the Celtics, Al Horford was great offensively with 22 points on only 13 shooting possessions, but wasn't able really to do much on defense. They really got carved up in the pick and roll. Smart, he's shooting okay on threes this year. The big limitation, I think, people always focus on his shooting, but to me his bigger problem is just that he can't finish in the lane at all. And he just tries to get fouled, doesn't succeed. He's got this reputation as a flopper now, and he just throws up a bunch of crap. Like, he doesn't finish strong. I thought that he was going to be this really athletic point guard coming out of Oklahoma State, and we just have not seen that from him. Maybe I just misjudged him, or some of the injuries that he's had have taken a toll. So, and then they're just not getting enough force inside. Olynyk, another guy who is a skilled player but is just not going to wow you. Like, for example, he's a smart player, he'll get into position, but there are just a bunch of plays where guys shoot over him, and because he's got these T-Rex arms, they're not worried about getting their shot blocked. Like Wall, I think, made 3 straight shots snaking the pick and roll to the right elbow, which is his shot. Olynyk knew what he was going to do, got there, contested, and just Wall made the shot over him. Beal scored over him as well. It's just, it's hard for him when he's out in space waste, guys just have the confidence to rise up knowing that they are not getting their shot blocked. So I'm not sure where this Boston team goes. I mean, that Jay Crowder shot it well in this game. Like, I think offensively they've exceeded expectations this year, but they lack the force. And Smart's comments after the game were good ones, saying that essentially they used to be a team that people hated to play against. And it's clear that that's not the case this year. And while I was pushing the don't panic button about their defense, I think it's getting to the point now where we're just going to have to assume that they're about an average defense. And that's it, unless they can maybe get one more guy as a big who can play conventionally, put Horford at the four and really clean up the defensive glass and block some shots. And then maybe they will feel a little bit more comfortable pressuring up on the perimeter, get some more turnovers, and they might be a little bit better. But unless they can make a move like that, you have to think that this defense is just not going to be adequate in the playoffs.
I still like a lot of their personnel, especially defensively, but you're right that without a rim protector, and ideally a rim protector plus rebounder, those guys are awfully hard to get. They don't get traded very often. It will be hard for them to reach their ceiling on that end or even get close to it. But I still believe in their potential on that end, particularly in a series against the Raptors, just because they have so many perimeter defenders. And as somebody who's seen the Spurs succeed with that kind of an idea, and that they'll play with more urgency at that point. But I'm not counting on it like it was before. It's just a possibility I'm open to.
Yeah, and we've talked about them as a potential Andrew Bogut buyout destination, and they do still have their full room mid-level exception, so they could offer him almost a little bit over $2 million once the trade deadline passes and Bogut were to get bought out, if in fact that happens. All right, that'll do it for that segment. We'll be right back with Corey Maggette. All right, welcome on. Special guest, someone I've wanted to have on for a long time because I've really enjoyed his work with Fox Sports. Also someone whose career that I followed because we actually graduated from high school in the same town in 1998. Former Clippers and Warriors star Corey Maggette. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing, Nate?
I'm doing well. Excited to have you on. I wanted to talk about the Clippers with you first because, as usual, it's been a roller coaster year for them with the injuries, and they've had the same core four together now. This is the fourth year since JJ Redick arrived from the Bucks for 2013-14 season. But you saw them at full strength for the first 10 games or so. They were awesome. Is there anything that you think was different about them during that period compared to past years where you thought there might be a different end result to the season?
Well, Nate, I thought we was going to talk about OPRF and Fenwick. How you beat it.
Well, I was nailed to the end of the bench when we played. I did play Corey Maggette in practice. I weighed about $170 back then, so all I could do was block shots, and they asked me to just try and block as many shots as I could. I didn't quite do the job that I wanted to impersonating you, but I could take some small credit for our victory in that one.
Yeah, I know I had to say that. But yeah, back to your question about the Clippers and the way they started the season out. What I would say, Nate, is they had a different approach. And you think about what happened to them last season. They lost to Portland. They had two guys, their best players, get injured. And then their bench had to step up. And so when they came in, they had a mindset that they had to win games. They had to be better. They had to have grit. And I seen them in training camp and the way they was approaching the game. You know, you had Kevin Garnett there who was active, you know, with DeAndre, with Blake, Chris Paul, the way he was approaching the game. And, you know, they really wanted to learn. You know, a lot of times when you have superstars on your team, you know, they're too good to learn where they can't listen to anybody. And I think when they brought KG in to kind of help with them during the season, they can listen to someone who was a champion, who was a 15-time All-Star, who was an MVP of this league, who was an Olympian, and sitting back and listening to his perspectives on how to be a winner and how to have the grit. And so then you had their transformation from to be just an okay defensive team into a really good defensive team. And at first, it always starts with DeAndre Jordan, the way he approached the game. And he's one of the best defenders in this entire league. And so for him saying that he could be better on the defensive end, even though he was one of the top in the defensive player of the year and first team all defense, first team all NBA, he came in with a different approach. And so that changed. Also, you have another guy, Chris Paul, who was on the second team, I believe, all defense. And so for them, they said in order for their team to be successful, they need to be better on the defensive end. The offense is going to be there. You have so many guys on the team that can shoot the basketball and who could score, from Blake Griffin, from Chris Paul, from JJ Redick, you know, who's pretty much lights out from the three-point line. And then you have these other components where you have sixth man of the year and Jamal Crawford off the bench. You have an emerging of, you know, Austin Rivers starting to come in. And so then they started to add these other pieces from on the offensive end from, you know, Mo Spink, you know, adding also.
Yeah,
you know,
Mo, I think, provided like a real element for their second unit.
Oh, man.
Shooting threes, at least offensively. I'm worried about his defense maybe in the playoffs, but offensively, like, because they could never score when Chris and Blake were off the floor, and they've done a decent job of that so far this year with his spacing.
You're absolutely right, and I think that kind of, you take that from what Mo has learned at Golden State. You know, you having superstars on your team, and you still have to be an important role to your team. And, you know, he came in, and he was aggressive on the offensive end. And a lot of times, you have to do that. You just can't say, all right, I'm just going to fit in. You have to play your game, and yeah, Mo did that.
They got the right guy, if that's what they were looking for.
Oh, yeah. But what I would say on a defensive end, you know, Mo has always, in the last few years, has been one of the top guys leading the charge set. And a lot of times, even though defensively, laterally, he's probably not the best defender, but when you have other guys around you that is good help defenders, it actually makes Mo looks good, you know, as far as him taking charges, being in the right spot. And I think in the beginning of the season, that's what happened with the Clippers. Everyone was in the right spot. And you know, you played this game, even though it was on the high school level, you know that on a defensive end, you need to be great. You need to be great as far as on help defense. That means everyone has to move together on a string. If you pull the string, a next guy has to be in that position. And the Clippers recognized that early on in the year and used their defense to fuel that offense.
Yeah, that 10-game start, they had one of the best defensive ratings relative to the league of all time. And maybe they're a little bit over their heads there, but that is kind of what they're going to have to play with if they, you know, once obviously they get healthy. Let's assume that everyone can get back. Chris Paul comes back okay from this hand injury. Blake Griffin, I think tonight is supposed to make his debut after the knee surgery. So if they're able to make it into the playoffs, they don't suffer any more injury misfortune. How do you like them matching up with some of their potential foes in the West? Why don't we start with Houston? Because I think that's who I'm thinking they're probably going to end up playing if Houston is the 3 seed and the Clippers might be the 6th seed. I guess they could be they're probably more likely to be the 5th seed actually and play Utah. But let's start with Houston first.
Okay. I would say the Houston Rockets is, you know, you look at the playoff a few years ago, Houston came out of nowhere and took the Clippers out. And so, you know, for the Clippers, you always have to be a concern with a team like Houston, because you don't know what type of Houston team you're going to get. You're going to get a Houston team that James Harden going to have 40, 10, and 9, and Ryan Anderson's knocking down threes. You know, Trevor Ariza is knocking down threes. You know, Eric Gordon. And then you can have, you know, the Houston Rockets where, you know, James could probably have 20-plus points, you know, 10 assists and 13 turnovers, and it throws off the momentum. And so, you know, for the Clippers, you know, when they're healthy, they are one of the best teams in the league when they're healthy. But the problem is, you know, when you're trying to fight back from injuries, and that means it, and it's not particularly the injury, it's the conditioning factor, because those other teams, they have been playing, they haven't been injured, they have momentum going. And so that's, you know, that's what I am concerned with the Clippers. Can they pick up the momentum, and also can you get Blake and Chris back to the conditioning where they can play? Because, you know, when, you know, the second half of the season, the games is just going to be going, you know, so you're not going to have a lot of rest time, you know, to get your body that rest that you need. And for those guys who's coming back from injuries, they need to have that.
Chris in particular, he's got that hand injury. From your perspective as a forward player, can you stay in just pretty much the type of shape you need to be in if it's like an upper body injury where you can still run around like that? Or is it still going to affect him just because there's no other way to do it other than actually playing in game?
It's still going to affect him, because you got to remember, if you have a hand injury or you have surgery, you know, you can't actually have any activity on the court because you don't want to get an infection from the sweat, etc. And so for him, it's going to be tough for those 2 or 3 weeks. And you know this, you know, if you miss 2 or 3 games or you don't have 2 practices, you're going to feel like your lungs don't fill out because you're out of gas, because you got to wait for your second wind to kick back in. And even though Chris is going to miss a couple of weeks, you know, those 2 weeks are crucial, because now he has to figure out how to get back in shape again. And I think that's going to be a crucial part for the Clippers. But that means other guys have to step up. Jamal Crawford, Austin Rivers, Mo Spinks, you know, Raymond Felton, who's playing great, DJ, you know, Brandon Bass, guys guys, to Wesley Johnson, those guys have to step up and kind of, you know, hold the fort until Blake and Chris get their momentum back.
So back to Houston, the reason I think actually the Clippers might match up pretty well with Houston is because of DeAndre Jordan. I think that really, if you want to have any chance of guarding Houston, you either need to be able to switch onto James Harden in that pick and roll, or you need a big like a Rudy Gobert or DeAndre when he's locked in, who can guard that pick and roll 2-on-2. Because once you have to bring that guy over from the weak side, James Harden is such a good passer, you're just going to be giving up threes all day. So I like the Clippers defensively against Houston maybe more than some other teams.
No, I totally agree with you, because when you have the anchor in DJ that can actually guard the high pick and roll extremely well, and he can guard James 1-on-1 if he has to, but then also he patrols the paint, that's going to be huge, because now that takes away one of James's strengths, which is getting to the foul line. So if he can't get to the paint and get fouled, that takes away, you know, 9 to 12 points. But also, you got to look and account is, even if he's getting inside the paint, you know, is Ryan Anderson going to make threes? Is Eric Gordon going to make threes? You know, so that is going to be a big factor is too. Like, the defense, we know that the Clippers is a defensive team that can stop Houston, but it's more about, you know, the passing of James Harden. If he can make those perimeter passes where guys start making shots, now that throws off the Clippers, where it's more guys have to run guys off the line, and that leaves next dribble drives and pass and penetrate, pass and kick shots for the guys.
So what about Utah? I'm thinking the Clippers will probably hold off Memphis for the fifth seed, with Chris not going to be back for a while. Utah playing very well, just had a 6-game win streak that came to an end last night against OKC. I'm thinking the 4-5 is likely to be Clippers and Utah. Utah having home court advantage. What do you think of the Clippers matchup with Utah?
Man, you know what? Utah is a dangerous team. And I'm going to tell you why, because they have, you know, Quinn Snyder, Duke guy, got to give him much props. You know, he has got this team to fall in line, meaning take the orders that they need to do to be successful. And when you bring in a guy like George Hill, that changes in the whole dynamic of their team. So you have a scoring point guard, but also, you know, George Hill is really known for his defense. And then you bring in a veteran guy like a Joe Johnson, who can come off the bench and he can score, you know, between 15 and 20 plus points a game. And then you have the emergence of, you know, Rudy Gobert, who's, you know, really patrolling the paint. He's been a very, very effective big in this league. He's one of the top big in the league. And then you have, you know, I would say he should be an all-star this year in Gordon Hayward, the way he's been playing. I mean, it's unbelievable. And we haven't even talked about Derek Favors, a guy who's coming off in their rookie, Trey Lyles. You know, they can get more of their injured players back. But Utah is a dangerous team, because not only that they play well at home, you know, if they take their home court advantage, but they're a good defense team. And so when you have another guy like a DeAndre and Gobert, who's patrolling the paint, that's going to stop a lot of penetration inside the paint, where now the Clippers have to rely on outside shooting. And the Clippers is not really a good outside shooting team, but size, J.J. Redick, Jamal, who's a streaking shooter, and Chris Paul, if he's healthy, you know, they have to give up those shots to Luke Matamute, who's actually been playing well, but that is a non-shooter that kind of puts the Clippers at a
difference. Yeah, I think that Utah matchup could be a real difficult one. It's just going to be a war in the paint, too, because Derek Favors guarding Blake Griffin, that's going to be really a great matchup. And I think that Utah bench could maybe cause some problems, as you talked about, with Joe Johnson and some of the other guys they have. Alec Burks is looking good again now for them. So I think that could be an issue. But I if those teams matched up and the Clippers were healthy, I would probably favor them. I think just because they have a little bit more experience than the Jazz. The Jazz, just their main guys haven't even ever been in the playoffs.
Well, you know what, Nate? That's when a team is really dangerous, because, if you know, this lead is all about momentum, and Utah has momentum. And you know, regardless if, you know, it's about experience, it's more about the momentum and how those teams is playing. So you still can't take, you know, Utah lightly. You know, like, I believe that the Clippers will win that series, but they still have to be concerned with the guys coming back. You know, when you talk about, you know, Alex Burks getting back to it, and then you have so much experience on a team from, you know, Joe Johnson. You have a champion on a team in Boris Diaw that know how to play. You know, we haven't talked about even Dante Exum, you know, who's much improved as well. But they have a lot of firepower coming off the bench, and that's going to be an issue if those teams can dig in and play well defensively and they start to make shots, that's where you have the Clippers struggling. And then you got to also think about it, man. You know, you're in Utah. That altitude is no joke. And so you have to be ready to play in those conditions and also with the fans and also with the officiate in Utah.
So what about San Antonio? We saw maybe the best first-round series of my lifetime, that series in 2015 when the Clippers beat San Antonio. It's a different Spurs team now. The Clippers, a little bit of a different bench, but mostly the same crew. What do you see when the Clippers and San Antonio, if they were to potentially match up in the playoffs?
Well, first of all, that was one of the most unbelievable series that I've seen. I was there. I watched the game. I seen when Chris Paul went down. I seen when Chris Paul ended up hitting the shot. I mean, that was, I think, the turning point for the Clippers. It was almost, it reminded me of, you know, the Bulls and Detroit, you know, back in the day where the Bad Boys was this tough team that had so much grit. And in order for the Bulls to get past, you know, to win championships, they had to beat that Detroit team. And that Detroit, after they beat them, they was able to win multiple championships. But the same with the Spurs. The Spurs has always been a team that the Clippers could not beat. And they found a way to beat them in 2015. And then, you know, the next couple of years, they have been able to beat this team. You know, that being said, with the roster that, you know, the Spurs have now, you know, their coach, man, this coach is unbelievable, Greg Popovich, what he does, you know, with the talent that he has. I mean, he might have a couple superstars on his team, but his role players, they understand this game. Their basketball IQ is off the charts. And then you talk about the development, you know, that they have in San Antonio. You think about Kawhi Leonard, you know, a couple years ago. You know, you would never believe that he would have taken this jump that he had.
Not at all. I mean, in that game seven, he couldn't score. He was being guarded by Jamal Crawford down the end of the game, and he couldn't score. That's a big reason, I thought, why they lost that series. He couldn't take advantage of that matchup. And then, you know, these last 2 years, I mean, you know, Jamal, he'll try on defense, but he's not going to guard Kawhi Leonard now. Like, the steps that he's made over the last 2 years really are incredible.
Exactly. Like, he's a series he was out. You know, he picks his spots. He knows that he can get a shot anytime he wants. And his lead is all about confidence. You know, it's 10% your skill, but the rest is all about your confidence. And Kawhi Leonard's confidence is off the Richter. And so that's why this team is, in particular, is very dangerous. San Antonio, because of the way Kawhi is playing. And also, I mean, it's just one guy, basically, who's been holding the four down. You know, LaMarcus Aldridge, you know, has had an okay year. Tony Parker. You know, subpar year. Manu, you know, and Pau Gasol, I mean, still subpar year, but they find a way to beat teams because they outsmart them. I mean, they basically use the Jedi mind trick on every team. And Greg Popovich knows how to do that. With every coach, he knows how to Jedi mind trick and every player. And then you have a guy who is a superstar in his league, and Kawhi Leonard, that guards and he plays every single possession like a Russell Westbrook, 48 minutes of the game, and he's going to kill you.
One team that the Clippers have not really been able to get past, though, is Golden State. In these last couple of years, the Clippers used to own Golden State before Steve Kerr came in. I want to talk a little bit about just what your strategy would be if you were the Clippers for defending Golden State. We've seen the Clippers switch a lot more defensively this year. Do you think that that's the way to go against Golden State, particularly when they go small at the end of games, or do you think a more conventional style works better?
Well, it depends on who you have in a game to go small against them on. So you got to think about Golden State, their small lineup. You know, that can be Kevin Durant. That could be, you know, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green. And then you could probably throw on an Iguodala, where it puts the Clippers at a disadvantage. Or they can, you know, you never know. They can throw in a JaVale McGee to probably match up with a DJ that's very mobile as well. That's a matchup problem for the Clippers, because not only is it a matchup problem on the defensive end, it's a matchup problem on the offensive end. You got three guys on the court that can score 60 points at any time. You have three guys on the court, and Kevin Durant, you know, Klay Thompson, and Steph Curry. At any time, these guys can get hot, and they are very efficient scorers. And, you know, we've seen over, you know, in the last, you know, 4 to 6 years that the Clippers was, you know, dog walking Golden State Warriors. And now it has completely changed around, and the Clippers cannot find a way to beat Golden State. And that's their biggest problem. That's their biggest hurdle. If they can ever get past the Golden State Warriors, you know, I believe the Clippers have a chance to win a championship. But it's going to be hard when you have, you know, basically the super team on this side, and then you have, you know, just the okay team side.
Well, so this is a good segue. The Clippers kind of right now looking like they might be the fifth seed. Memphis, it may not even be an issue because Memphis may just not play that well. But if you were the Clippers, would you be thinking about, hey, you know what? If we are in the 4-5, we're going to have to play Golden State in the second round. Are we better off just falling to the sixth seed? We know we have a good team that's played together. The regular season doesn't matter that much at this point. We're not going to get home court advantage anyway. Are you better falling to the sixth seed and just being in the opposite bracket of Golden State, or can you just not think that way?
Well, I tell you this, as a competitor, you can't think that way. You just want to go out there and win games and put yourself in a better position where your team is playing inspired basketball. But if you're looking at it from a managerial standpoint and coaching standpoint, where Doc Rivers is wearing three different hats, you know, you have to look at that type of seating where, you know, is our chances better if we, you know, if we're in a fifth seed, if we're in a sixth seed, if we're in a fourth seed, you know, you have to look at that, because there's no possible way that you want to play the Golden State Warriors in the first round. You know, that's basically death. That's like you losing to the Portland Trail Blazers in the first round. And so it's going to be a tough thing in this second half of the season. You know, will you see, you know, the Clippers, you know, resting guys, you know, where, you know, games that they should win that they all, you know, that they ultimately lose? You know, you never know. You never know. As a player, like I said, as a player, you know, they're competitors. They're not thinking that way. They're trying to put themselves in the best position to win games. You know, they want to make sure everyone is on the right accord. And sometimes, you know, as players, you know, they send a message to the coaches. No matter what team that we're going to play, we're going to be ready to go. That's when you have momentum going into, you know, the second half of the season, being going into the playoffs. But the Clippers, on the other hand, is a team now that they have to find that momentum again, because they have had their stars out. You know, Reggie Miller said it better than anybody. The best ability in this league is availability. And when you don't have your available superstars in this league, you're not going to win a championship. I don't care how good your bench is. You're not going to win a championship when you don't have your stars. The same thing happened with the Cleveland Cavaliers when they lost Kyrie Irving. That's tough. It's a mismatch for Dellavedova to go up against Steph Curry. But then you saw the following year, it's a mismatch, but you saw the following year when you had a superstar playing against a superstar, and we've seen the results of that.
So I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk some about your career, your experience as a player. And arguably, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but there are certainly discussions at the time that on that 2006 team that made it into the second round and almost beat the Suns, that you guys kind of wanted to play Denver because the seeding system was all screwed up at that point. They were going to be the champions of the Northwest Division, but they weren't nearly as good as Dallas, who was in the four seed, I think, that year, and was a really good team, 60-game winning team, made it to the finals. What do you remember about that time? Like, is that actually true that you guys kind of rested guys, took it a little bit more easily? And if so, you know, how did you feel about that as a player at the time? And then after, when it kind of actually worked, how did you feel about it?
Well, I would tell you this, I remember the talks of that about the seeding. And I think Mike Dunleavy, you know, who's, you know, very strategic in what he does, was looking at the situation where you can give the Clippers a better chance. And from a player's perspective, we were just trying to win games. I'm not going to even lie to you. And then for me in particular, you know, I was battling a situation coming off an injury. And then where, you know, instead of being a starter, I had to be a six man. And so you had all these different things trying to fit in this new role. I'm talking about myself in particular, you know, trying to be a six man, where Dunleavy said, hey, we're going to go this route. And then for me, I have to put my ego aside, you know, within that Denver series, which, you know, I was the leading scorer. I mean, I led the lead that series in scoring in that series. But our team in particular, I mean, we had such a good team, but we knew, and like I said, I'm going to go again to Mike Dunleavy. He's very strategic. He knew what position would benefit that team. And what would benefit us was playing the Denver Nuggets, which they thought was, what was the words? Let me think of the words that they were saying about. They was unorganized at the time. They had a lot of guys that was hot-headed. Kenyon Martin, Carmelo Anthony, who was, you know, still kind of immature. They had a lot of guys that, you know, if you threw a lot of dirt at them, you know, they wanted to fight back and change the whole series. And they used that to our advantage.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Who were they starting? Do they start Quentin Ross? Is that who they started?
Yeah,
then?
Quentin Ross. Quentin Ross ended up starting. I mean, great guy. You know, unbelievable defender. I ended up having a Liz Frank injury in the beginning of the year. I did against the Miami Heat, and you know, I had to battle back, and you know, it was always just this push and pull from Dunleavy. You know, where you know I kind of thought, you know, he was being dishonest. You know, say, you know, you're going to put me back in the lineup, but then you know he didn't. So it was always a back and forth, you know, with that situation. But yeah, that was a big thing for our team, is, you know, trying to, you know, strategically get the Denver Nuggets in that series.
Yeah, that must have been interesting for you, because I mean, obviously Quentin Ross was a good defender, but you know, couldn't really shoot at all, and you're clearly a much better player than he was. And was it hard? I mean, I assume he was saying, well, you know, we want his defense out there or something like that. Was it difficult for you to take a back seat? And how were you able to still contribute when, you know, someone that you probably were right to say was an inferior player to you was starting?
Well, it was hard. And a lot of times, and for me now being an older guy, and I understand, is, you know, your ego can hurt you in so many ways, you know, and, you know, a level of maturity. And so for me, you know, believing, you know, that I should have been playing, and of course I know I should have been playing, and I should have played more minutes, and you know, I should have been a starter, but you can't think about the shoulda, couldas. You just have to go out there and play basketball. You cannot worry about the politics and in the game. And you know, for me, you know, I had a chance, you know, one of my best teammates, and Sam Cassell, and Sam and Katino Mobley would come and talk to me that entire series. Like, hey man, I know that you might not want to be in this position, but we need you in order to win. We need your firepower. And you know, they really empowered me. And I mean, and that's in this league, you know, you with your teammates, you know, 95% of the time, even more than your family. And so you really take the information, you take the leadership from those veteran guys, in a Sam Cassell, in a Katino Mobley, to listen to them, because, you know, they knew about the ups and downs of this league. And so really buying into the system. It wasn't Mike buying into what Mike Dunleavy was wanted to do. It was really buying into my teammates, because my teammates was the guys that I was going to war with on the court. You know, I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to let them down. And so in order to do that, I had to put my ego aside and just go out there and play basketball.
So you played in a lot of different situations for a lot of different coaches. When you, either a new coach would come in or you would move to a new situation, you know, you're getting to know this coach. Like, I'm sure you had some coaches you thought were good, some who weren't necessarily. Like, what were the criteria in your mind for to kind of tell, all right, this coach knows what he's doing, or maybe this coach, you know, isn't as good?
Well, I tell you this, the number one rule for any coach is communication. The number one rule, you know, you can be the worst coach in this league, or you can be the greatest coach in this league, but communication is always the key. Because you have so many different egos as a coach that you have to manage on a team. And it's not just the coach's position to manage it, it's the assistant coaches to be the buffer for the head coach. And a lot of times the good coaches figure out how to use the assistant coaches to be a buffer, but also as a coach, as a general, you have to also be able to communicate with your players and let them know. And the understanding that if you do have veteran leadership on your team, or veteran guys on your team, is you can't not just talk to them because you know it's going to hurt your team. And so, you know, those were always the criteria that I looked in for a coach. Would he be a communicator no matter what? And I've had, you know, like you said, I have so many different coaches. And, you know, now that I look at it, every coach was good in their own way. You know, you had coaches that I would say, like a Scott Skiles, who was this just tough, hard-nosed coach, that he understands the defensive concept. He knew how to stop teams, but he was a bad communicator. And then you had, you know, you think about Mike Dunleavy. He was really good on the offensive end, making up play calls that he knew. He was one of the coaches that knew how to make me successful on the court, every single play. But also, it was a lack of communication in so many parts. And then you had you know, Donnie Nelson, you know, with Golden State. This coach knew he was the epitome of playing small ball. You know, he was the guy who originated that. He was the guy that said, hey, you know, when Steph Curry was there, hey, Steph, you know, even though you're our point guard, you might be guarding, you know, one, twos, and threes. You know, he put every player on a team in different situations that you was uncomfortable in that made you tougher, made you have more grit. But also he knew in order for your team to be successful in the system that he wanted, we had to be the best conditioned team. So we had to all, I mean, our conditioning was unbelievable because he wanted us to be an up and running team. And then you had a guy who, Paul Silas, you know, probably, I would say, probably my best coach that I've had. First of all, he treated his players as they was almost like his kids, that he held them accountable, but also he had a respect level for them. And then also he earned the respect of his players. And the players knew that. And he communicated with his players. He's talked to his players. And then lastly, when I had my, you know, my training camp experience, and I ended up getting hurt with the San Antonio Spurs, you know, Greg Popovich, who's, you know, one of the greatest coaches in this game, the ultimate communicator, ultimate. And you don't, it's a reason why that he has championships. There's a reason why that Tim Duncan and, you know, Tony Parker, these guys invite Pop to his wedding. You know, there's no way I probably would invite any of my coaches to my wedding. I don't think I had a relationship with it like that. But they invited him to because they respected Coach Pop, and Coach Pop respected him. He communicated with all his players individually and amongst the team. And so, you know, I just remember when Coach Pop, when he brought me and said, hey, you're going to make this team. But Corey, I'm going to tell you this. It's going to be days that you might not play, but I need your leadership. I need your veteran leadership. I need you to be a great teammate. And I just want to let you know this before we even get this started. And you have to totally respect that as a player, and you have to respect it as a person that he's going to be straight up with you. He's not going to sugarcoat it. You know, Pop is going to tell you the truth.
Yeah. And why doesn't every coach just do that though? Like, why doesn't every coach do that? Is they just don't feel confident enough to really be honest? Is that what the issue is?
And I don't know. I think it's a lot. You know, you don't want to hurt guys' feelings. And to that point is, guys want you to tell the truth. And sometimes you might get your feelings hurt in that process. But I think guys would be able to take it more if the coaches are truthful and direct and honest to them in a respectable way. And I think that is a key. Like I said, Coach Pop, Paul Silas. Is one of the guys who knew how to do that. Even Donnie Nelson was big. If you know, basically, if you was dogging it, he's going to tell you. He's not going to hold his tongue for nobody. And I think a lot of times you have to do that. And you, like I said, you earn the respect of players. You earn the respect. I think it is in this league or in general, you have to earn respect. Your respect is not given. You have to earn it.
Well, do you remember any times when, you know, a coach would say to you, all right, you know, you're not hustling enough, or you're not defending enough, or you know, you're taking too, whatever. Whatever it might be, and you're like, no, I don't agree with that. Like, that's ridiculous for you to say that. I mean, what was your reaction when the coach would tell you something that you, being a smart player, you just didn't agree with what he was saying?
I would say it wasn't about the disagreement of a coach. It was a lot of times when you're communicating with coaches and coaches communicating with players, you're going to have disagreement. You know that. I mean, you might not like something. You might not like something that I say or when somebody's on your podcast, but you have to, you know, voice your opinion. And I think in order to be a great communicator, you have to be able to take criticism, but also you got to be able to take criticism back. And then, you know, to be able to get your thoughts together and figure out what's the best solution. And a lot of times is, I think from coaches, even though the coaches and I think players have to really understand it, they are in a place of authority. And so as a place of authority, and I was always taught from my dad and my mom, the person who is in a place of authority, it's a respect level that you have to already administer, but also you have to earn their respect from both. And I think for coaches is, and good coaches understand that regardless if a player is upset and pissed off and, you know, want to have more playing time, you know, you have to find a way to diffuse that, but also you have to still find a way to get that person to buy into your system, and to not only as a coach, but you gotta as a coach understand how to change as well. You know, coaches in this league sometimes want to stay the same, and that's how they suffer. You know, a good coach, you know, even Coach K, you know, he never wanted any player in the league in college basketball to leave early from the Duke program. That he did not want that to happen. But I
yeah, you were the first one, right? The first freshman, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but now you look at the situation now that Coach K understands that, hey, you have to change and you have to evolve. And he even said this, you can't be the same because things will pass you by. Time will keep moving. And I think that's a key that I would say to being a successful coach, but also, you know, to being a successful basketball player, understanding your role. When you don't have it on the court, or you're getting older and you have a younger guy coming to step up, you have to understand your role. You got to understand that you have to be a mentor. You got to understand what the game has given to you. You have to give it to somebody else. That's important to understand.
So the last question I wanted to ask you, this has been in the news a little bit now. Steve Kerr had some comments yesterday saying that, hey, you know, what the players were given the All-Star voting, and, you know, some of them voted for just some guys who, like, didn't play at all so far this year. 30% of them didn't vote at all. You know, Steve Kerr was kind of lamenting that. What do you think of that? Players wanted to have All-Star votes. Now that they get it, a lot of them apparently didn't take it seriously. You know, what do you think of that? And is there a way that you think that it should be done? Because I'm sure, you know, a lot of players are like, oh, the media or the fans don't know what they're talking about. But now when they got the vote, they didn't take it seriously either.
Well, I would say this, man. The players fought and wanted to have them, you know, have the ability to be able to vote. And Steve Kerr, right, you have to take the time and vote. And I don't believe, you know, what I believe is you should have coaches and players. And then after that, I would say media. And then after that, I would say, you know, fans to be able to vote. Because first of all, I think the coaches know who are the best players in this league. You know, fans vote off. They vote off what they might like, but they, you know, forget about what a player might do for their particular team. I mean, perfect example, DeMarcus Cousins, probably one of the most talented players in this league by far. And he probably would not get voted in because of, you know, he might not be a fan favorite, you know, but also he might not be a fan favorite with coaches. But from a player's perspective, you know, when he steps on the court, he's one of the hardest players to guard. And to Steve Kerr's point, the players, you can't just be 30% of the guys voting, you know.
Yeah, well, 70% voted, 30% didn't vote. But yeah,
30%. But that 30% should have voted.
Sure.
You know, so you have to be accountable for that, because it's important. It's important for the league. You know, I think that guys, the players should vote. It should be 100% voting rate for that.
Yeah. Totally. So All-Star does really matter to you. It's just the idea that, oh, it's an exhibition, it doesn't matter. You think it does really matter?
Yeah. I mean, I think All-Star is great because you get a chance to you know, recognize players who have put their heart, sweat, and tears on the court and have elevated their players as well as their teammate to the next level. I think it's important. I mean, you know, I think it makes guys understand that they can always get better. You know, it's never the same. You know, next year you could be better or you could be worse. So you always try to better yourself. And I think, you know, the level of All-Star, it recognized that. It recognized that, you know, players have put in the work to be, you know, one-time All-Star, five-time All-Star, or 14-time All-Star. That shows that they still love the game, and they want the fans to understand. They want the coaching staff. They want their players to know that, you know, they're not going to stop just because they had one on. They want to continue to get better.
Yeah, I agree with you. And they talk about All-Stars all the time for when it gets time to, like, be in the Hall of Fame and stuff like that too. So I do think it's important. All right, we've taken up too much of your time. I want to thank you so much for coming on. Where can fans follow you on Twitter?
Twitter is Corey Maggette, Corey_Maggette.
All right. Well, thanks so much. This was great. I really appreciate you coming on. And we'll be back tomorrow with some more great content. We'll talk to you all then.
Hey, Nate. Well, I'm going to tell you this. We're going to have to go back to Old Park, man. We got to play one-on-one at Fenwick and at OPRL.
Oh, no.
Got to do that now.
Dude, I actually tried to play at the D-League Showcase. There was a pickup game in the morning. I would have told you about it, actually, if because like some of the executives playing that. Well, because I hadn't talked to you at that point. We got introduced at the D-League Showcase. That's how we planned this podcast. And sadly, I am the Tiago Splitter of pickup basketball. Like, I've the last like four times I've played, I've like pulled my calf muscle. So
man,
I need
that,
to, like,
I say this, Tiago, that's my guy, man. I can't let you talk about my guy Tiago.
Well, I mean, I know he could play. I love that acquisition for the Hawks, and then he's not being able to get on the court, like, because of these calf injuries he keeps happening, and now it's like the same thing happened to me. I mean, you know, we're pretty much the same age, so you know what it's like to be 36. But man, you know, I don't have the excuse of like, you know, a decade long NBA career for why my body is broken. I just don't have the genetics.
Oh man, well I'm telling you, we get back to Chicago, we have to go up to our schools, man. That'd be fun.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks again for coming on, and looking forward to catching up with you again soon.
Nate, thanks again for having me.